content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Greg Cockcroft from the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is The Atlantic. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from The Atlantic magazine. Our first article today, The Logic of the Filing Cabinet is Everywhere, by An Zio Mina. 17 years ago, just as the periodic cicadas were getting ready to arrive in droves in the eastern United States, Google announced Gmail, an exciting new email service. It had three key features: search, making it easy to find emails, storage, with what was then a mind-blowing 1 gigabyte, and speed, with emails threaded into conversations that ostensibly eliminated the need for cumbersome folders. Today, as the cicadas have seemingly taken over parts of the eastern U.S. once more, Gmail and Google's G Suite, now used by more than 2 billion monthly active users around the world, still largely operate on these same basic principles. Google figures only briefly in The Filing Cabinet, A Vertical History of Information, a new book by Craig Robertson, an associate media study professor at Northeastern University. But it's impossible not to think about the little search bars we live with every day while reading it. Like the once ubiquitous 8-track tape, the filing cabinet was an essential marker of modernization that's now considered clunky and outdated, with none of the mystique that some objects such as vinyl records and wind-up clocks have acquired over time. But Robertson's captivating history makes the case that when the file cabinet was invented in the 1890s, it represented a new mode of efficient work. And today, its legacy informs some of the most innovative technologies, including search, Siri, and the way we organize the files on our computers. A vertical filing cabinet, Robertson writes, allowed a user to find papers at a moment's notice, or almost instantaneously. It has a couple of origin stories and at least two inventors. The Library Bureau, a library supply company that built a prototype based on an idea from a secretary in Buffalo, New York, and Edwin Seibels, an insurance sales agent who tried and failed to get a patent for his version. With the right tabs and folders, a filing cabinet made the process of sorting and collating documents intuitive. Strategically, it was sometimes advertised as a machine of its own, alongside the then-nascent telephone and a calculator. The turn of the century saw a flourishing of office innovations, and marketers made sure to use the words such as equipment and appliances, rather than furniture. This naming convention plugged the humble filing cabinet into the world of modern technology, granting it the same sort of pizzazz that software developers today aim for in describing, say, a computational process as artificial intelligence rather than just a computer program. The 20th century also saw an emergent information paradigm shaped by corporate capitalism, which emphasized maximizing profit and minimizing the time workers spent on tasks. Offices once kept their information in books. Think Ebenezer Scrooge and his quill pen. The filing cabinet changed all that, encouraging what Robertson calls granular certainty, or the drive to break more and more of life and its everyday routines into discrete, observable, and manageable parts. This represented an important conceptualization. Information became a practical unit of knowledge that could be standardized, classified, and effortlessly stored and retrieved. Robertson's deep focus on the filing cabinet grounds the book in history and not historical analogy. He touches very little on big data or indexing and instead dives into the materiality of the filing cabinet and the principles of information management that guided its evolution. But students of technology and information studies will immediately see this history shaping our world today. Curious about the chemical composition of quartz? Google will show you the results in a series of stacked cards and provide tags and bits of structured data that help you sift through the results. Need to know the capital of Bhutan? Ask Siri and a friendly female voice. Most filing cabinet clerks were women, the book reminds us. We'll do a quick scan of digital records and provide a helpful answer. Thimphu, situated in the western part of the country. But if the filing cabinet, as a tool of business and capital, guides how we access digital information today, its legacy of certainty overshadows the messiness intrinsic to acquiring knowledge, the sort that requires reflection, contextualization, and good faith debate. Ask the internet difficult questions with complex answers, questions of philosophy, political science, aesthetics, perception, and you'll get responses using the same neat little index cards with summaries of findings. What makes for an ethical way of life? What is the best English language translation of the poetry of Borges? And what are the long-term effects of social inequalities, and how do we resolve them? Among the many charming aspects of the filing cabinet are the vintage advertisements peppered across its pages. One Shaw Walker campaign promised a filing cabinet built like a skyscraper, but simple enough for a child to operate. A Yaman and Irby ad called files the treasure chests of business and showed a woman peering lovingly at a tidy set of tabulated folders. Then there are the peripherals. Remington Rand's multi-sort device, for example, claimed to help clerks sort hundreds of papers quickly before placing them in filing cabinets. The physical design of the filing cabinet itself, in other words, helped tell a story about modernization and ease of use. These advertisements show most clearly how the architecture of the filing cabinet informs modern information organizing. We riffle through the rectangular boxes of search results and email with a swipe of our fingertips, the way we would file with file folders. Browser tabs, the blessing and curse of web surfing today, help us sort content. The tabs display a brief summary of what's inside. Modern search relies on a process called indexing, which aims to store and parse data and to maximize information retrieval. Contemporary machine learning systems tend to rely on data classification and cleaning done by a host of invisible workers, moving quickly through data like the office clerks of yesteryear. But the sheer scale of the effort makes these classification systems and algorithms difficult to comprehend. The opacity of our information systems comes with a cost. It would have been absurd in the early 20th century to ask a file cabinet worker for answers about matters that lie outside the scope of daily business affairs. If you wanted to pull up client correspondence, the file clerk had a file for you. If you wanted to understand John Locke's theory of mind, they'd probably point you to a library. There you would also encounter filing cabinets with index cards organized by author, subject, or title following the Dewey Decimal System. Such a system didn't replace books, but rather made them easier and more efficient to locate. And books are just one part of a system of learning that might include other forms of media, discussion with peers and mentors, and life experiences. Unlike the granular certainty of information, the acquisition of complex knowledge is multimodal, evolving experience, something modern information systems can only begin to support. The coronavirus pandemic is just one potent example of this tension between information and knowledge. In the early days, it became clear that very little was clear about what was going on. Questions about COVID-19's transmissions, its prevention, and its range of symptoms were subject to further inquiry by scientists and researchers. Our information systems were rife not simply with misinformation, false or misleading information, but what I call mid-information or informational ambiguity based on scant or conflicting evidence, in many cases about emerging scientific knowledge. An information environment designed for certainty butted up against a hazier reality. Last spring, scientists were learning how exactly the novel coronavirus spreads As a consequence of a reasonable level of concern, many of us regularly wipe down food packaging, mayo, and countertops. By last May, the CDC had updated its guidelines, confirming that surface transmission is possible, but likely not the main way the virus travels. As the global health scholar Emily LaRose has written, sometimes online information is partially true, but misunderstood because it is incomplete and inadequately contextualized. Sometimes science just takes time. Can emergent knowledge coexist with an internet that privileges certainty? The mystery of periodical cicadas is an example of mid-information at work. Knowledge about them evolves in fits and spurts as different broods appear every 13 or 17 years. We still don't know why their life cycle follows such an odd pattern, or how they calibrate their internal clock, but we at least have new tools that could help collect and classify more data about them and bring more people along in the process of learning about more about these creatures. In the spring of 2019, Gene Kritsky, the Dean of Behavioral and Natural Sciences at Mount St. Joseph University in Cincinnati, released the Cicada Safari app to encourage citizen scientists to document cicadas around them. Key metadata, time, date, and coordinates are captured, and the images are filed and tagged after being verified. Already, the app has yielded surprises for Kritsky and his team, such as the first-ever documentation of off-cycle emergence in certain broods. As he reminded me, even the large data set enabled by the app is simply establishing a baseline for 2038. Changes in geographic spread, declines in the population, the effects of deforestation, these are all potential observations we'll have to wait another 17 years to study further. As data points about cicadas improve over time, I imagine new mysteries will emerge. Such is the nature of knowledge. Today we live with more information at our fingertips than in all of human history, yet our lives are filled with questions. And besides, entomological data may never quite explain the pathos of these creatures, which have symbolized death and rebirth for the ancient Chinese and ancient Greeks alike. The reason we find their red eyes so haunting, or the fact that some people find their song captivating while others find it annoying. Information collection and distribution today tends to follow the rigidity of cabinet logic to its natural extreme, but that bias leaves unattended more complex puzzles. The human condition inherently demands a degree of comfort with uncertainty and ambiguity. As we carefully balance incomplete and conflicting data points, competing value systems, and intrinsic framework to arrive at some form of knowing. In that sense, the filing cabinet, despite its deep roots in our contemporary information architecture, is just one step in our journey, not its end. Next, an opinion piece by Ann Applebaum, written last month, entitled "Give Russia's Frozen Assets to Ukraine Now." A majority of Americans and a majority of Congress want to help Ukraine win the war against Russia and to stop the spread of autocracy into Europe. The majority of people in the European Union and a majority of EU leaders want the same. But small minorities of lawmakers, some inspired by Russian President Vladimir Putin or his money, some bent on bargaining for other things, have managed to block or delay that aid. On both sides of the Atlantic, the crunch has arrived. The far-right faction that now controls the Republican Party captured the House last year and has successfully blocked a new spending bill for many months. The Prime Minister of Hungary, himself a de facto autocrat, is also blocking an EU financial package for Ukraine. Eventually, the European prime ministers and the Biden administration alike may well do deals and allocate the money. But in the meantime, and just in case they fail, there is something else that American and European governments can do. At the very beginning of the conflict, the U.S., the EU, the United Kingdom, and other democratic governments jointly froze more than $300 billion in Russian sovereign assets, mostly in Europe. This is money that Russia cannot sell or borrow against, nor can Russia make use of any of the interest this money earns. At the time, many believed that the decision to freeze these assets would shock the Russian government into pulling back. That did not happen. After nearly 2 years, the countries that hold these assets, all of them, should take the next step and transfer the money to Ukraine. Lawrence Tribe, the American constitutional scholar, has been promoting this idea for some time. In September, he and a team of lawyers published a 187-page report making the legal, practical, and moral case for transferring Russian assets to Ukraine. The moral argument is the easiest. Russia should pay for the damage it has done to Ukraine. The fundamental legal case, Tribe told me, rests on the many treaties that Russia broke by invading Ukraine, destroying whole cities, murdering civilians, deliberately damaging power grids and grain storage. By doing so, Russia lost any standing to complain about the violation of its sovereignty or property rights, since it denies those to Ukraine. In truth, we in the West have already crossed that bridge when we froze the assets in the first place. If you have the authority to freeze the assets, Tribe told me, you have taken them away from the sovereign that claimed to be their owner. Why should they now have to lie idle while a country is decimated? The frozen assets would solve some of Ukraine's immediate budgetary and financial problems. More important, $300 billion is a reasonable down payment on the reparations that Russia should pay to Ukraine. Russian money should rightly compensate Ukrainians for the harm that Russia has done and help rebuild the Ukrainian infrastructure that Russia has destroyed. The strongest Western objections to transferring the frozen Russian money to Ukraine have been practical ones. Tribe cited an inchoate concern that hegemony of the dollar will be threatened, and people's willingness to park reserves in the U.S. and other Western countries will be jeopardized. Some countries may fear that their own assets would be at risk if kept in Western financial institutions, and will instead place them in China or elsewhere. A handful of Europeans fear that redistributing the money would set a precedent, encouraging others to take their own national assets. A range of public officials, including former Treasury Secretary Larry Summers and former World Bank President Robert Zolnick, as well as David Cameron, the new British Foreign Secretary and former Prime Minister, have nevertheless argued in favor of the seizure. There isn't an alternative reserve currency to the dollar right now, or anywhere safe outside the Western-dominated financial system for investors to go. Besides, as Tribe's report argues, assisting Ukraine in its time of need is worth the speculative risk to the dollar. This part of the argument has more significance now than it did in September, when Tribe and his colleagues published their report, because the stakes for Ukraine are higher and the need to take risks is greater. The crisis in Western funding, a crisis caused, I repeat, by pro-Russian politicians and factions in our own societies, some of whom are coordinating their activity with Russia, is now acute. It is also visibly emboldening Putin, who last week gave a press conference restating his goal in Ukraine, which is the same as it was 2 years ago, the destruction of the Ukrainian state. The dysfunction in Washington and Brussels is bolstering Putin's belief that he will win the war simply by waiting for the West to give up. Handing $300 billion of Russian assets to Ukraine will put a dent in this confidence. It will show Putin that the West is willing to take creative, even unprecedented measures to win the war. It will also be popular, not only in Ukraine, but in the U.S. and Europe. Most people will intuitively understand the fairness of making Russia pay for its own act of vandalism. Whatever reputational damage this transfer of assets might cause for the West, it is vanishingly small in comparison with the reputational damage that the West will suffer if Russia succeeds in conquering Ukraine. The sooner we make this decision, the more quickly the impact will be felt on the ground. What are we waiting for? Next, exile changes you forever. Hisham Mattar's new novel looks at the price of being forced out of one's home and the impossibility of ever really going back again. This was written by Ben Rhodes. The onset of the Arab Spring can feel like the distant past amid the grim brutality of our current times, but it raises timeless questions. What is the trade-off between courage and safety, idealism and caution, hope for change and fear of it? In hindsight, we can tell a story of how the wave of revolution crested and the undertow of counter-revolution prevailed. Autocrats remained in power. Uprising turned into simmering civil and sectarian conflicts. Millions of peoples sought a refuge in a West that so often fails to recognize their common humanity. Still, those timeless questions haunt Hisham Mattar's riveting and humane novel of exile, My Friends. While the novel works its way up to the Arab Spring as the climactic revelation of character, the fulcrum of My Friends is one of those extraordinary events lost to history. On April 17, 1984, a group of Libyan officials sprayed gunfire at a demonstration gathered in front of their embassy in London. A 25-year-old British policewoman was killed. Several Libyan diaspora protesters were wounded. After an 11-day siege of the embassy, with the strongman Muammar Gaddafi threatening reprisals on the United Kingdom's diplomatic corps in Tripoli, Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher expelled the embassy's entire staff from the United Kingdom. Diplomatic ties with Libya were severed. The gunman went free. Gaddafi's war with the West continues. Mattar, a Libyan born in exile, tells the story through a fictional narrator named Khalid Abd al-Hadi, a Libyan gravely wounded in the shooting. Born in Benghazi, he is the son of a scholar who became a schoolmaster to avoid politics. Khalid is moved to study literature by two events in his formative years. He hears a short story called The Given and the Taken by a Libyan emigre named Hossam Zawa, read on BBC Radio. In the story, a man is incrementally devoured by a house cat. When the cat has nearly consumed his entire body, the man finally speaks up and says, "No." Then Khalid reads an essay by a professor, Henry Walbrook, at the University of Edinburgh, which posits that when a work of literature is translated from one language into another, its meaning is inevitably altered for bad and for good, something lost and something gained. The short story is an allegory for Gaddafi's Libya, and ultimately for exile itself. The essay becomes a kind of metaphor for Khalid's life and his experience of exile. He gains safety but loses who he once was in the process. Khalid narrates his story over the course of a night wandering the streets of London, a middle-aged man looking back on more than 30 years of exile. Most of the drama happens shortly after he moves to the United Kingdom. He wins an opportunity to study at the University of Edinburgh, and a few months later, his friend Mustafa persuades him to attend the demonstration. In the crowd with his compatriots, Khalid is momentarily euphoric. "I do not think I have ever before or since felt such solidarity." Then the boys are shot. As they recuperate in the hospital, returning home is unthinkable. The regime would imprison them. Khalid can't tell his parents what happened because that might endanger them. He can't go back to university because the regime has spies there. His life, as he knew it, is over. "Be invisible as a ghost," he tells himself. "You are now a danger to those you love the most." A wealthy Libyan oppositionist gives him a set of clothes and £1,000. The British government gives him asylum. The rest is up to him. At the core of My Friends is a powerful juxtaposition of loneliness and camaraderie, self-reliance and dependence, which defines the outline of exile. Khalid ends up living more than three decades alone in a small, tidy flat in London's multicultural Shepherd's Bush neighborhood, yet he relies on a constellation of close friendships. Each of these relationships reflects a different aspect of his exile and a different way of being in the world. Kali turns to Professor Walbrook, the literature instructor whose essay inspired him to study the subject. The professor becomes a surrogate British father, taking the place of his Libyan one. When Khalid calls him shortly after the shooting, Walbrook asks, in an uptight British kind of way, "Do you know what you need right now?" After a few weeks' time, Khalid calls back with a newfound British sensibility. Money, a place to live, and an education. They make a plan, and Khalid pursues it. He reads in the British library, mainly stories of others in exile. He changes universities. He becomes a teacher, a Libyan Brit instructing teenagers on English literature, moving between two worlds, just like Walbrook, the Walbrook essay he read as a teenager. Khalid meets Hossam, the author of The Given and the Taken, years after the shooting. In the presence of the writer who once stirred him, he takes a rare step of sharing his history, which he regularly hides from others. Khalid tells Hossam that he is puzzled by one fact of Conrad's story of exile, that he burned his father's papers when he reached England. By contrast, Khalid still feels tethered to his own father and to the Libya in which he remains. "It's an accomplishment, I think," he tells Hossam, "a genuine achievement to forget one's father. I would like to do that, to wake up one morning and commence life without giving him a thought." We ask of writers what we ask our closest friends, Hossam says at one point, to help us mediate and interpret the world. At its best, the literature of exile offers a different window through which we can see ourselves, because the exile, like the writer, stands apart. Matar passes no judgment on the answers his characters choose amid forces beyond their control. But at a time when it's almost too late to say the word no before those forces consume the world we knew, he shows us, with masterful command, how life happens at the intersection of the personal and political, what we can control and what we cannot. The writer Ben Rhodes is the author of After the Fall, Being American in the World We Made. He is a former speechwriter and deputy national security advisor to Barack Obama. We've run out of time for today's episode of The Atlantic. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Greg Cockcroft, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The Atlantic is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service. Have a great day.